Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favour to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Sammy Lando. Morning, Sammy, or afternoon, rather. How are you, man?
I'm very well, thank you, Yas. Yeah, very, very good. Looking forward to chatting some football, and it should be a good chat.
Definitely. Sam, before we just jump into the deep end of it, straight off to you, you know, who is Sammy? Where did he start his journey and how did you get into it?
The way that I like to think about Sammy is he was a young National League coach, so sort of worked my way up from the non-league. I'm also more known for being football's first substitution coach, so a role that I sort of invented, and future Premier League champion is what I'd like to think. So a little bit of past, present and future, I think. But
I love that.
You know, the journey started when I was sort of a little bit of a nipper, and obviously, I always love football. It's the dream, isn't it? It's everyone's dream. You want to play it, want to be a Ballon d'Or winner and all the rest of it, but never quite good enough. And unfortunately, I lost a sight in my right eye, sort of accident when I was a little bit younger in a car crash. So playing was always going to be tough with you know, half your vision. So for me, it was like, what's the next best thing? Next best thing is to work in it. And my journey's sort of been a little bit of recruitment, a little bit of analysis, a little bit of coaching, and it's sort of all fed into where I am today, which is quite nice. So everything happens for a reason, I guess.
No, 100%. I think we've all got our own journeys that we're on. And it's quite interesting. Obviously, you talked there about, you know, growing up wanting to be a player. And, you know, I never actually thought about that when I was younger, thinking about, yeah, win a Ballon d'Or, but it's always just become a pro, right? but yeah, no, it's, so I guess, you know, from that, you know, you talked there a little bit about your accident and whatnot. How did that impact you in terms of your coaching to start off with? And, you know, when did coaching first start coming into play with it?
Yeah, it was like I still try. So it happened when I was like 10 and 11. Naturally, it sort of stunts your development, you know, because you're in and out of hospitals, had a lot of surgery. So, you know, my physical development was behind probably what the average was. So, you know, I always struggled a little bit. But then sort of when I was like played to 14, 15, 16, but then it was a bit like, well, you know, it's not going to go any further. So I'll continue to play leisurely. But like now time to like focus on the pathway that I want to go to. So, yeah, started focusing a little bit more on like scouting and analysis because I didn't know if I had the personality to be a coach. I didn't know if I had the charisma. And at 16, you're still learning yourself. So I think at that time, I was a little bit more wanted to be in the backgrounds and you know, I like numbers, I like, you know, observing things. And so that took its natural progression. And the more I got into like analysis and scouting, you start thinking, I can affect this, I can affect what I'm seeing here. And then that's where like coaching is, isn't it? Where you can start influence a result or influence a person's development. And yeah, so it was sort of, like I said, it's been like quite a nice journey into it really, because I'd never really maybe set out wanting to be, I wanted to be in football, but the coaching role just came about because I enjoyed observing things and then being able to affect the outcome of it. And I think being able to be on the grass and with people is something that is a big big value to me.
I love that. And it's just so interesting you talk about it, because you know, you started off by saying the next best thing is working in it, right? And I think that's probably one of the things that's kind of really sparked me in starting the podcast, in, you know, through my own experiences and, you know, all the people that I've met and engaged with, and just helping people understand that, you know, there is places in football for everyone. And not, it doesn't have to be coaching for everyone either. So I think often, you know, traditionally you think, all right, if you're not going to be a player, let's be a coach. But actually, as the time's gone on, especially in the modern day game, there's so many different roles. And, you know, you started off obviously talking about the specialist role, which you've kind of embarked on as well. And so let's before we get to that part of it, though, let's talk about the scouting and then the analysis piece, because obviously that piece is obviously, you know, fundamentally laid the foundations of where you're at now. What was it about that in particular? And was it more so that at the time you felt that, like you didn't really have the personality for coaching, that's why you wanted to maybe just do something different to kind of keep yourself involved? Or was it that in the initial stages, coaching just wasn't on the agenda?
Yeah, I think it was more that I didn't feel ready to be a coach. You know, I think being a coach has a lot of responsibility. You know, there are people that you're not in charge of, but that you're influencing and that you're working with. And I think you've got to be the best version of yourself in order to coach, because, you know, sometimes, especially with kids, you can just say one throwaway comment and it could be the kid. That's the one comment they listen to all session. And then it's like, you know, you've got to be so ready to be a coach. And I think when I was 17, 18, I wasn't ready for that. So scout was a really good way, like you said, to be involved in football, but not necessarily be at the forefront of everything. You know, you could make a few mistakes. You could learn along the way. You know, I was able to go and I worked at Brentford as a scout just in the academy before it shut. And that allowed me to go in and watch all these great coaches, you know, do sessions in the academy in the 18s. And then that allowed me to start build my repertoire of like, how does he act as a coach? What sessions does she do as a coach? And allows you to put together a little bit of a portfolio similar to with analysis. You know, it's a little bit closer to being on the grass because then you're filming sessions and clipping things and chatting with the coaches. So again, it was one step closer. And then that final step was sort of being a coach. And scouting and the analysis was really important to, as you said, laying the foundations, because I think, you know, empathy is a massive thing in football. So to work as a scout and analysis, I can then sort of link that into being a coach. I think you can really merge all the things into your process. And by having done the experience, I think it really put me in a good position to build this sort of process that I want to build.
And I'm smiling at some, because you've got my head going in so many different directions right now, right? You know, I want to say, well, let's go back to the scouting to start with, right? Talk to me about that in terms of, you know, what does a scout actually look for? You know, obviously everyone's different. Obviously, how much of that is influenced? You know, we talk about bias, you know, whether subconscious and conscious biases, how much of that is aligned to what you're looking for? And I guess, how has that experience as a scout now supported you in your coaching? And do you think it's actually now on the back end of it, now going into coaching, if you were to go back into the recruitment piece and scouting in particular, that you probably would have a greater eye for observation, if you like.
That's exactly it. That's the biggest word that I took from scouting was observation. Like, it taught me the ability to be observant. And I think that is the most powerful tool at that stage of my development that I had, is that when I would watch this game of football, I would notice who interacts with who and how. I would notice who reacts to a negative situation or a positive situation.
Give me an example of that.
So, for example, I always think the biggest thing is when a player comes out, you know, is he high-fiving the mascots? Is he, you know, does he clap the crowd? Does he, you know, is he the first one out? Is he the last one out? You know, does she help get the equipment in when the coach is packing up? Does she, you know what I mean? All these little things help build this character assessment. And I'm not for one second saying that that's a fair reflection of them, because they're in a game day. They might be just being a little bit of a zone or something like that. But you start understanding people and how they work and what motivates them, what they like, what they don't like. And I think when you have that skill relating it to being a coach, I think that's crucial. Like when I set my session up for anyone I coach now, you notice all these little things, and it all contributes towards a sort of like larger process and larger valuation of them that you're trying to build. And particularly, I've done a lot of coaching with youth players, and you know, football is a way that you can instill values. So when you're coaching these young people, when I say, you know, lads, we're going to need the goal down here. Once you've got the goal down here, I know you're ready to move on to the next part of the session. And I watch the same two lads go and get it every week. I just think that annoys me. They're like, that just doesn't like sit well with me. You know, this is a team. That's what football is. It's a team game. If you want to be an individual, go and play tennis or go and play a sport where you just have to look out for yourself. But this is a team game. So go and help them, go and share the load. And that comes from being observant when I sat and just used to look at hours of stuff, and that was really useful.
It's interesting, right? Because, you know, I was thinking, sitting there thinking about everything you said then. You know, is that some of your own biases that are talking there in the fact that, you know, how this person maybe presents themselves pre-match, during the warm-up and all these other things? Because on the other side of it, there'll be people saying, well, actually, do they show up on the match day and do, you know, when they step over the white line on for 90 minutes, do they do the business? Do you know what I mean? So I think there's so many different aspects to kind of delve into what you said there. But I guess one of the things that it takes my mind to straight away is when I'm speaking to coaches in particular, and we're looking at, I'll give you an example, you know, you're looking at it starting with your journey as a scout. Do you not think that some limitations on that, in the fact that if you have some coaching experiences, you may be able to see some different potential within the player based on how you might want to coach them or some of the experiences that you've had as a coach, and you know that are going to potentially influence that as well. And, you know, what are some of the pros and cons you think that exist there?
Yeah, I think that's a nice perspective. And one thing that I did when I was a scout was that we would always, or as part of a contract, we'd have to go in and watch the current players. So what they looked like, how they acted, what were their technical standards, tactical standards, how the coaches acted. You know, you'd have to know as a scout the environment, because when you go and watch these players, like you said, this player might be unbelievable from minute one to minute 90, but then not clap the fans. But then you're thinking, well, our environment is the sort of environment when a player comes into, you teach them these values. So he's got the technical, but is there, you know, is our environment going to be able to add a little bit to his character or a little bit to his development and that sort of thing? So yeah, I definitely think there's value in merging the processes. I like that there's departments in football, but I think the more loosely those departments are sort of like intertwined, everyone's process gets a little bit more layered and a little bit more deep and a little bit more thorough. And like you said, that's where I think the value lays. That's where the marginal gains are had.
It can be quite territorial, right? Because, you know, you know, certainly from my experience, you people in the scouting department, the recruitment side of things, you know, they're very set in their ways, and it can be very, very, you know, I guess, rigid in what they consider potential to be. And I guess one of the questions that always kind of goes through my mind when I'm speaking to scouts or people from the recruitment side of things is, how much do they put a consideration? Do they even look through the lens of, do you know what? I've come to see Sammy, but Sammy's going to be a great player because I know that he's going to be working with such and such coach. This coach is going to be able to get how much of that is a consideration of yours in knowing that this player is going to actually be paired with this particular coach? You know, is there even that consideration in there? And what, you know, if there was that there at the beginning of your journey, or did that eventually start coming in at a later point?
Yeah, I think that started coming in when I actually started doing a little bit more analysis work, because then you start sometimes as a scout. Again, I was a little bit younger, so I was learning the trade, but you look a little bit like, is he the finished product? Well, no, so we don't need him. Like, you know, he's maybe not going to be that beneficial for us. And then you start understanding. And one of my bosses said, always just look for one outstanding attribute, because if he has one outstanding attribute, then we can build around that. And then all of a sudden it's like, if he's the fastest player you've ever seen, you know, then all of a sudden you go, well, we can teach him the back foot receive. We can teach him to, you know, when to press, when not to press, and these things. And that only came in, I think, a little bit when you start pairing it with analysis, and you start then matching it with a little bit of data and a few clips and a little bit more of a profile, and then start going, well, this player might be able to do this. And there's some clips of our current winger who's doing it. Let's link it to what this profile is playing. You start to, like you said, marry the two together. And maybe the consideration wasn't there at the start, but I think that was part of my development into analysis and into a little bit more.
And it's interesting, you obviously talk about your journey into analysis as well. And I think, you probably agree with this, that we're starting to see a lot more now where people with analysis backgrounds are now transitioning into coaching in particular. And it's probably sought after more than anything than ever before, even.
Yeah, massively. Yeah, like I did an article with The Athletic a couple of weeks back about coach analysts and how I think that is a fantastic sort of hybrid role that marries two skills together to probably produce another level. And I think that there could even be more examples of that, whether there's a sports scientist coach, you know, a coach who is a great coach brass with tactical, but can also really consider physical elements of the training session. So is a coach sports scientist going to be next? You know, is there going to be other departments that merge to create these hybrid roles? Because it's actually more beneficial to have someone who can do both rather than just like an individual doing that and an individual do that. You know, there needs to be that bridge in between. So I think it's...
No, definitely. So I guess just building on that, then, you know, you're talking about your, you know, the idea of, I guess, having dual roles, if you like. When does a dual role start to become a bit too generic, though? Because obviously you still need your specialists, and, you know, I might have some experience in analysis, but at the end of the day, I still need to be able to do it to a certain standard. But then on the flip side of that, it's also aligning that to making sure that what I'm analysing is in line with the perception of what the club are looking for as well. And obviously those perceptions might be different at certain times.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think the barrier, or like where you talk about like generic and not being a little bit brief, I think it requires still departments of experts, and it just requires the bridge, if you will, as the role is now, you know, to marry the two together, to be good at both. So not excellent at one, but maybe good at both. And then it requires, you know, a few excellent people in the analysis, few excellent coaches, and then a good analyst coach to be the bridge and the personable person in between. So I think that is a really important role.
100%. So starting off as a scout, transition to analyst, talk to me about that journey. How did that become a thing for you? When did you start thinking, okay, I want to go into analysis? And what did that look like for you?
So again, the opportunity came not necessarily through me looking for it, but sort of just by being offered it. So I was a scout at Brentford, academy shut down, came down to Bournemouth, was a scout at Bournemouth, and then worked my way up a little bit, did a little bit of work with the 23s. And at 23s at the time was a coach called Mark Moseley, who had also got a dual role with Weymouth, who were in step three of non-league. So, you know, he would be Bournemouth 23s in the day and go and do non-league in the evenings and nights. And he said, you know, like the way you work, be really interested if you wanted to come over and just do some opposition work. Because obviously opposition work is a little bit analysis and a little bit scouting. So it was a little bit of that first step into actually analysing upon a scouting observation, if you will. So that was the first little step. And then my role grew into being pretty much all the opposition analysis. Then it grew into being a little bit more about the comprehensive stats of the league and the trends and things that we could exploit and identify to use to our advantage. And then it started going into player profiling and that sort of thing as well, where we're going, you know, I've noticed that this player does this, got a little package here of clips that I've put together, I'd love to show it to him and think that we could actually get more out of him if he's like this. So yeah, it was probably a transition through the roles and responsibilities, but I love the analysis side of things. It was a real passion for me.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, I remember when I first got into academy football in particular, and obviously, you know, that's probably the real first kind of step where you start to really understand, you know, all the multiple disciplinary teams and all the different staff and all the specialists, and it always kind of baffled me how there wasn't as much collaboration as there possibly could have been. And it's almost like they might not be necessarily the best in the world, but they're considered experts in different areas of the game, right? Or different areas of the talent development, if you like. Why are we not talking to each other more? It always baffled me. And then I guess when in the role that I kind of picked up on at the time, you know, I was doing a dual role as an outfield coach and a goalkeeping coach, and it was just, why would I not speak to the analyst? Why would I not speak to the S&C coach? Why would I not speak to the physios to understand a little bit more about how they do things and what they want and what they think is, if you like, best practice or most effective ways of working? Because if they understand me and I understand them, then we can just put together a better program, right? So I guess, you know, linking that back to yourself now, where were some of the influences for you in terms of the analysis piece that you felt, okay, do you know what? Actually, this might be a good piece to do, or, you know, what kind of sparked some of the ideas that you had there around, you know, maybe putting together some individual clips and things like that? Because for me, I've always said I value the analysis piece. I never really had much passion or interest in it myself, but then that changed for me a couple of years ago, where I was kind of shown a new way of doing things or a different way of doing things that I hadn't considered before, and it's like, do you know what? Actually, this thing, you can't not use it. It just makes sense. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, no, the first part of that question, I suppose, is that the best managers are delegators, in that they appreciate that knowledge is power. So, and they appreciate who the experts are and how you utilise them. Because if you just have 10 people in the room who all think like you, you argue that it's a useless room because you're not being challenged, you're not being elevated, you're not being layered in any way. So yeah, having that program, like you said, of bringing all the experts together to contribute is the ideal process. I suppose I'm unsure why more people don't do it. Probably the $1 million question in director of footballs at the moment. And the second part of that question is what sort of made me think about these ideas. And the biggest skill that I've had probably since I was a nipper was that I just love problem solving. I love solution mindset of finding ways to solve problems. And sometimes when you're scouting and analysing, you identify these things and then you start thinking like why am I still seeing this? Like I've noticed he's you know, chopping on his left and always swinging it 6 weeks in a row now. Like, why is no one addressing this? And that's where my natural instinct of like, oh, I've got to get out there and do something. Like, I can't just let this continue to happen. So, and that's where that coaching again started to come in, because I then started to feel confident enough in my knowledge and my skill set to think I can go and change this. I can go and impact this.
And it's interesting. I'm just linking back into, I want to take you back to something you said earlier in that starting your journey, you didn't think you had the personality to be a coach. And it's a conversation I've had with a lot of people recently around, well, what does that actually look like? What did the personality of a coach look like to you back then? And how has that view differed, if at all, any?
Massively. So back then, like, I'm 26 now. So like, let's say 12 years ago, 14-ish, when I start thinking about this sort of stuff, you know, 12 years ago, football was a completely different landscape. Football was, and also I live in a tiny town called Shaftesbury. You know, we have a Costa and a Tesco's and there isn't a lot else. So it's not like I'm really, like, the nearest football club is Bournemouth, which is an hour away. Like, so I don't think I was really had much football exposure growing up. I don't think that we are blessed in this particular area of a rural area, that there is much, I suppose, football opportunity. So I wasn't exposed to this education of what it looks like and what it might be like. So the only exposure I had in football was like my grassroots coaches and my PE teachers and stuff. And they're all brilliant, don't get me wrong. But you know, there's a reason why they're not in the Premier League managing. It's because it's not their dedication. It's not their full-time job. So, you know, they're going to be a little bit rusty at times. So yeah, my exposure to coaches wasn't necessarily that big. But then when I started going into Bournemouth, Brentford, Weymouth, you start seeing quiet leaders, loud leaders, powerful leaders, purposeful leaders, you know, really, really sort of like demanding leaders. And then I start looking at myself and going, I think I can actually see myself in one of these molds and skill set could actually be used in this role.
Just on that then, because, you know, it's a conversation I mean, just literally a couple of days ago I was having with someone around high performance, right? And where does it begin and where does it end, right? And the idea that grassroots coaches and even grassroots environments as a whole can't demonstrate high performance behaviors and actions, right? And it's just almost this mindset, and it's certainly from my experience, it'd be interesting to get your views on this as well, and in your perceptions, in that it can't belong in grassroots. It's like, well, actually the behaviors have to start somewhere, right?
Massively. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think, like I said, football is an opportunity to instill values, and you don't need to be a Premier League manager to do that. You need to be a person with a good understanding of people. That's all that takes. You arguably don't even need to be a football coach. You know, there are people out there who understand what selflessness is, and they could go into a team and they could probably coach selflessness because they understand it. You know, they might lose every week because maybe they don't understand what a back four looks like, but they can instill values because they're good, and that's what people understand. So no, I completely agree that I think it can start anywhere. I also think it can be instilled by anyone. I think a player could 1 week and go, you know, I'm gonna lead the warm-up today, and you've got to ask some accountability and some ownership that, you know, that's a high achieving attribute, and then you praise that, and then someone else wants to do it. And yeah, I absolutely think it can be anywhere. It doesn't have to be at the top.
And I think that word that you've used there is massive in every element that I have working, whether it's coaching or coach development. That accountability piece is so important for me, and I think that, again, you know, I often get challenged with it when I support coaches in grassroots environments, even work with players in grassroots, in that you're almost the critique is you're being too hard and you're being too honest. Well, no, I'm just holding them accountable. Someone has to do it, because if they don't get held accountable, then they'll never know whether they're, I guess, there's no one to check them, essentially. Do you know what I mean? And if there's no one to check them, how are they going to get better?
Massively, yeah. Like, behavior has consequences, and the only way that you learn that is through sometimes saying, I think you were wrong, like, I think you were, or I think you were right, or I think or I think that, you know, in this situation, in debate, I think this side of the squad see it a little bit better than I think this side, you know, and I think that's why you could probably argue that maybe high performance is even more important in the younger years than the older years, because your makeup of a person is done, I mean, probably earlier than, you know, 10 to 12, 13, 14, probably even earlier, but to get it right there, you know, like, I hobby of mine is to like look at all these high achievers, and you know, you look at Michael Jordan's, you look at people who have really dominated their sports. So Conor McGregor was a good example for a period of time. Michael Jordan, obviously, Cristiano Ronaldo. You look at all these high achievers, and you know, their skill set and their mindset is developed so early that it's just their consistency and relentlessness that makes them successful. You know, they don't become successful at 26 because they start doing stuff like Michael Jordan's. Hard work, relentless commitment, and that would have been at 10 years old, you know what I mean? So as long as it's done in the right
100%. And I think that, you know, just leading on that, you know, one of the things I often get critiqued for is telling players that wasn't good enough. And you know, it's almost to that point where, and it's again a debate I have with coaches sometimes around, well, when does great just become good? Right, you know, obviously, you know, if you start doing something that's, you know, I guess extraordinary, it's you know, it's not a common occurrence for Sammy to be doing X, Y, Z. But now I've seen Sammy do it a few times. Well, actually, why am I still praising it? It's like, yeah, well done, you got there, but that's just the new benchmark that you've set. I can't keep praising you for that, because you're just going to sit in your comfort zone, aren't you? So it's just that piece of, right, okay, well, I know you can do that now. So yeah, that's not going to get my praise anymore. You know, how do you feel about that sort of thing?
Yeah, I like that point. It's probably not one I've considered too much before, because again, I've started probably working more with senior players, and so it's a little bit, I think you adapt a little bit to that environment, and sometimes older players love obviously praise just as much as anybody, and senior players, but necessarily done in a slightly different format or a different method, and I suppose they know sometimes they have to set standards. So sometimes I've actually always said that I think it's good to coach standards, but the more you coach standards, the less you're coaching football. And I think, again, it changes with what level you're coaching at. But when we're at Weymouth and we've got to go and win, or Wimbledon or whatever, we've got to go win a game of football, you know, arguably if I'm coaching football, that's going to help us win. And if you will coach your own standards, then, you know, no one has to waste any breath on it, and we can really utilise this 75 minutes for football.
That's about setting the culture, right? Because, you know, you're now getting to the point where you're getting the players to hold each other accountable, because they understand that is the standard, right? So, I mean, you have to kind of start with that somewhere, and if it never happens, then they'll never, you know, you're kind of just hitting and hoping to an extent, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly that. The culture, you know, I suppose defines the behaviours that are done within this environment or a set environment. I think, yeah, culture, so important. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't coach culture, but I don't think you should coach it on the training pitch. I think, you know, that players should come out wanting to be early, wanting to help, wanting to try their hardest, wanting to do all the right things, because that's their job, that's their role, that's their dream.
Yeah.
And I can coach a better footballer, and that's what's going to help us sort of kick on in a little bit.
No, I fully agree with you. The only thing I'd put, you know, if I'm playing devil's advocate, the only thing I'd challenge there is that you might have players who that is their dream, that is, you know, they want to be able to do all those things, but they've never been part of an environment that's actually demanded that of them. So, you know, I guess there's that kind of blend, right, where we have to, or we're going to have to coach some of the culture piece and actually, you know, kind of hit it from two angles, if you like. But something interesting that you mentioned a couple moments ago around, you know, working with senior players, and tell me from your perspective, you know, what are the differences between working with seniors and senior players and, you know, youth players, essentially?
I think for me, like, it's the way that you communicate is probably the biggest thing. Like, you can never talk to a 19, 20-year-old Premier League loanee the same way that I'm going to go and talk to a 9, 10-year-old who's just playing for enjoyment. You know, I suppose the motives behind why we're playing a little bit is different. So, therefore, I'm going to have to adapt to that situation. And you know, not that the points will be identical, but probably what you say is going to be similar, because it's football, you know, it's the sport, so there's going to be some similarities in what you're saying. But yeah, I suppose the way that you handle yourself, it has to be a little bit different, because this Premier League star is going to come down, and I mean, why is he going to listen to me? Like, I'm not the goat of football, so you know, I have to then come across a little bit more, I don't know, friendly and a little bit more like I want to try and challenge them in the right ways, rather than maybe with the 9-year-old, you could be a little bit like, you know, look, I think you need to trust what I'm saying here, because I believe that I can add another layer to your game.
So give me an example of that, you know, working with senior player where you've had to kind of, I guess, for lack of a better way of describing it, work to get the credibility, if you like.
So we had a player at Wimbledon who, again, this links a little bit into the subs role, so we'll touch on that a little bit, but had a player at Wimbledon who struggled being a substitute. Now, I mean, every single player in the world seems to struggle with that because of the connotations and stigma that come around being a substitute. So again, that topic of conversation could be relevant to a 9-year-old, but is also now relevant to this 27-year-old who's played 200 games in professional football in various leagues and clubs. And so we sat down and we talked a little bit about why it's negative and why he feels so bad when he's not selected. And we sort of like, we almost just talked as me and you are right now. And we were open. I said myself, like, I'm here on a journey as well, and I'm going to try and find out along with you why this reason is happening. And we came to the conclusion that it was because it was his identity. He was a football player. He wasn't a football substitute. So this whole 200 game playing and his whole career in academy, he's a football player. He's been taught to play. No one's ever taught him to substitute. No one's ever taught him to consider a different perspective of football from not playing. So he was just having a little bit of an identity crisis. He couldn't understand his role. He couldn't understand role looked like, what his identity now looks like. And so what we did is we sort of just sat down and we talked about different ways and different identities that he has. So he's a dad, he's a best friend, he's a husband, you know what I mean, he's all these other things, and he can do those, and that's his identity as well. But we also sat and talked about, well, you're gonna have to accept this because you are a substitute, and I don't make wave a magic wand to put you in a starting lineup, and the gaffer obviously needs to see something a little bit more at the moment in order to put you in that lineup. So what can we now do to help that? And what can I do to help you achieve that?
Yeah, 100%. I guess just, you know, my mind's taking me to the idea of, well, you hear about it all the time, right? Certain players who are just actually more impactful coming off the bench than they are starting the game. You know, how much of that comes into it? What in your eyes is the role of a substitute?
Yeah, well, the role of a substitute is links to the we, not me. So that's the first saying, is that as long as the team walks away with 3 points, that's the biggest success of it all. So not whether I got on and made an impact, not whether I got on and played, not whether if we as a collective have left that stadium with 3 points, then we've all done ups. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, how can your role assist the people who are starting, who are playing, or who are coaching to go and help get that 3 points? So the goal is to get 3 points. And then the role is, how do we all do it as a collective to help whoever it is at the front of the line leading us to get the 3 points?
So I get, you know, and it sounds brilliant in an ideal world, but you know, you're dealing with people here, right? You're dealing with people that, like you said, they might have played, they might have had 200 starting appearances in the Football League, or, you know, whatever level they've played at. And I guess coming to the terms of the fact that that's not going to be them anymore, you know, that's probably a massive challenge and a massive transitionary period for them to kind of adjust and adapt to. So, you know, how do you sell that to them if they're not used to that?
It's a variety of things, and I think that's what the substitution concept is, because like what I'm talking about now is an impactful sub is more from a culture point of view, but an impactful sub from a technical point of view is completely different. So there's different sort of lenses to look at it through, but the strategy sort of used are, you have to make them see that the only way to add value to a game isn't just through playing. So we had a nice moment with a club where centre-back was on the bench, and traditionally they don't get substituted that often. So as a substitute, as a centre-back, you know, you are one of the players who are last in line unless there's a send-off or an injury. So I said to him, what could you do today to help your other substitutes? You know, how can you do that? And then half-time, we always do a little bit. I'm out there and I'm working with a striker, and the centre-back has got the winger, and he's doing 1v1 scenarios. So the centre-back plays into the winger, winger drives at him, try beats him 1v1, gets a cross or a shot off. And second half, about 15 minutes in, you know, winger comes on, exactly the same part of the pitch, winger produces a successful 1v1, chops in, wins a corner, we score from the corner. Now, that action doesn't happen unless that centre-back is putting him through that muscle movement and that neuroscience and making sure that all his instinct is in line. So I got to the end of the game, I said to the gaffer, I said, I think it would be really nice if you went over and said to this centre-back, like, appreciate what you did at halftime, because it's added value to this player's game and it's added value as a team because it was the winning goal. And that player felt like he then added value and contributed, and he understood his role most of the time was going to be playing, because I don't ever want a player not want to play. But it's also about being, if you're not playing, what can you do to assist other players, coaching staff, to help us get 3 points? So that was a really nice strategy.
I love the phrase, and you know, and it's something I always say as well, about how you're going to add value. And you know, if you're not sure about how to add value outside of being a player on the pitch, then that's where the coaching should come into it, right? It's just helping them understand some of the impact of that. And I think the key bit is that recognition and the acknowledgement of actually what you've done has added value. And you know, I always go with a phrase of what gets rewarded gets repeated, and they just hopefully buy into the concept of how else they can add value to the team. And I think that bit's so key. So I guess let's talk about your role then. Where did that come from? No, who wakes up one day says, "I'm going to be a substitution coach"?
So I always thought that I could. Again, talk about maybe not wanting to be a coach or whatever, but I always thought I was good enough to be at the top of the game. I always thought that I wanted to test myself against the best. I wanted to try and compete the best, challenge the best, and that sort of thing. So, again, coming from a really rural town where there isn't a lot of football history, I had to do something to put myself on the map. So, done pretty well to get to Weymouth. You know, I was 21, 22. We worked through the analysis section. I'd been appointed first team coach. Was in the National League. So I was 22. We were going to Notts County's, Wrexham's, all these sorts of places. I was on the training pitch leading. So I put myself in a good position. But then for me, I was like, well, how do I take this to the next level? How do I break into the Football League? How do I break into the Premier League? How do I break into the national scene? And so we went through a stage in COVID where we didn't have enough players because we were a part-time team in a full-time league. So I started getting named as a substitute. So the gaffer gives me a call, says, "Get in a little bit early." I'm like, "Yeah, right." Like, talk through our pressing shape again and get some, you know, resources ready. Pull up, walk into the changing rooms, and they've got this big Lander 13 kit up on, you know, my shirt, my shorts, my shinies. And I'm thinking like, wow, like, I'm in here. Like, this could be the start of my playing career, like, let alone anything else. And he says, "Yeah, you're as a substitute. Like, again, we might not use you. We only got three subs. We've got a keeper, a centre back, and you. And so, like, it's a good chance you could come on. You know, we're playing Maidenhead. So, what it is, 89th minute, striker goes down. Gaffer turns to me and he says, like, you're ready to come on. Like, you're gonna have to come on in a minute." I'm thinking, like, Christ. Like, I'm in the bench coat. I'm in tuned in with the game because it's my coaching role. But like, I'm got a few jelly babies here. I'm talking football. You know what I mean? I haven't moved in about an hour because I'm sat in this freezing November boat sort of like coat. So I just think then it was like a light bulb moment. I thought, wow, like, this is horrible. What a horrible moment this is. This can't be what every single substitute feels like. And the consensus is that most substitutes actually do feel like that. So that was the light bulb moment where I thought, like, wow, there's definitely something that can be done here, by the way. Like, this can't be the norm. And so, yeah, it started developing, and it sort of turned, add layers and snowballed into this like massive concept where it then had loads of different angles and different roles. And yeah, it was mad, to be fair. But it's about me being a problem solver. I thought, this can't be it. You know, I've got to go and influence this. And that's where it sort of started.
I guess in some ways, you could say that if it had you not been a substitute in that game, you probably would never have appreciated what that meant, right?
Yeah, and it's empathy. You have to live a role sometimes to understand the role. I think you can have a level of empathy towards being something, but until you've truly lived it, I don't think that's like a level of empathy that you can just get. So I lived what it was like to be a substitute on 3 or 4 occasions. Yeah. And I was, wow, like, there's something here. So yes, I think I completely agree.
100%. And I think one of the key things obviously within that is, even if you have been through the experience, I think it's important to understand that everyone, I guess, responds to those experiences in different ways, despite the similarities that might exist within them, right? And I think for me, I'm just thinking about it aloud and thinking to myself, blimey, coming on 89th minute. Like you said, and I think it just really, I'm just thinking now as a coach, probably puts more emphasis on the idea of, right, making sure the players are ready when they're coming on, making sure they are warm when they're coming on. You know, probably have a different appreciation and understanding for that as well, right?
Yeah, well, like, it was literally like the gaffer had just turned to me and said, right, I need you to get up, I need you to hit your top speed, and I need you to run into that 6'5" centre-back and win a duel. And I'm sort of here in my bench coat, having not moved for it. You just think, like, no sports scientist in the world would recommend that. No warm-up, no anything. Like, I could pull a muscle straight up. And it's, and again, like, it's not groundbreaking, and there's other parts of this concept that adds legs. But things like that, it's being inclusive in football. It's making sure that your players feel ready, because if a player feels ready, you're going to increase the probability that he can have in a game of football.
So let's talk about them. Obviously, there's going to be people listening to this from, you know, different walks of life and working at different levels of the game, whether that be in academies or in grassroots football or anywhere in between. Because this is a piece that I'm always kind of harping on about, especially when I'm out watching games and I'm working with coaches in grassroots in particular, where it's like, well, if you know you're about to bring that sub on in 10, 15 minutes, obviously, if it's an injury or something like that, you can't plan necessarily for that. But how do you, you know, the challenge I always put in is how can you preempt, or how can you prepare for the worst case scenario, right? And it's just making sure the players are always warm. So I guess from your perspective, what are some things to maybe for coaches to start to think about around making sure the players are ready to come on, making sure, and obviously, you know, making sure they're warming up properly. How many times do you see it, you know, especially at grassroots environments where, you know, you see the coach tell the players to get ready or to come on, and they literally just do a little a 5 or 6 high knees on each side and they're ready to go. It's like, well, you're not going to be ready for a game like that, are you? So, you know, what are some of the insights that you can share with that?
Yeah, and it's, I would not say it's worse at professional level, but when I first came into some clubs, their substitute warm-up is go down the touchline, drop to one knee, chat to their mate who's on the opposition team, open the gate, close the gate, run back up, get in your coat, and you're done. And you just think, like, sports scientists, or even the gaffer saw you doing that, you know, if the starter did that, you'd question whether they were ready, whether their head's in it, what's up with them. But for some reason, substitutes seem to get, like, this free pass, and it's like, oh, yeah, he's a sub, so he, you know, he's all right. But it's like, kind of can't be allowed. So, yeah.
I mean, I think there should be even a greater emphasis on the sub being fully ready, right? And I was one of the things that, it's one of my bugbears, really, when I see substitutes getting ready to come on, it's just like, you're not ready. You're definitely not ready. You know, I guess a lot of this comes back to guidance, right, and support in terms of, you know, what can we do as coaches to help them become more ready to come on? Because it's not just the physical element; it's actually the psychological element. Like you said, you touched on a few times already. In that, what are they? Do they understand what their role is coming in? Do they understand? You know, how much? And you know, you see it all the times, you know, whether at grassroots, whether at professional level. How often are the subs really paying attention to what's going on versus that of them just sitting there sulking a little bit internally around not being played or whatever that looks like. And maybe just because of those mindset challenges, they're not even prepared to come on in the first place. Because, you know, if that striker doesn't get injured, you don't come on in the 89th minute. In fact, you're watching 89th minute thinking, yeah, I can't wait to get back inside now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, how do you manage that?
I think you touched on it brilliantly there, where, like, I do have a lot of processes that aid both the staff and the players. So we find ways to be more deliberate with substitutions and data driven and all that sort of, and that's more of the coaching side of things. But we also implement a load of processes that helps the player experience of being a substitute. And the physical and the technical and the technical, they're all brilliant, but they don't happen unless the psychological or the mental side of things is there. Because, like I said, you can have a player who's physically ready, technically ready, tactically ready, but if he feels like rubbish, you know, I very rarely do I see someone who feels like rubbish be able to perform at the highest level. So it all starts with the mental, but then once you start changing, like you said, the culture and a little bit more about around what a substitute is viewed as or a finisher, then you can start going into your, right, then how do we prepare him physically? How do we prepare her technically? How do we prepare him tactically? And those things, again, have to be a little bit careful with what I reveal, because obviously it's the thing that's maybe a little bit relevant. But one good example, actually, I said on a podcast the other day, is shirt and shinnies. So the average substitute gets 10 minutes. The average substitute takes 60 seconds to get ready. Well, you've just taken 10% of your game time away because you've just taken a minute to get ready, because you don't have your shirt on, you don't have your shinnies in, you know, you don't have your boots tied up. And so you're not ready if the gaffer turns around to go. So you're wasting game time. And as a substitute, you know, your game time is valuable. You know, they're the slight 3-4 minutes that you get given to make the manager believe that you should be in the starting 11. So to waste one of those by taking your big coat off, taking your big trousers on, getting your shirt on, putting your GPS in, like, all this sort of stuff can be ready. So we have these sayings of the clubs that I go around. We say shirt and shinies. You make sure your shirt and shinies ready at all time. Because like you said, you also don't know when a red card's going to happen. You don't know when a really serious injury is going to happen. And they're going to be off in like 20 seconds. And then your team might be down to 10 men for a period of time because you're not ready. And all these little things can contribute towards it. So yeah, shirt and shinies is one of the easier things that I can sort of recommend.
No, and I think it's a great point because, you know, we see it all the time, right? Players, in fact, they don't believe they're going to come on. They don't think they're going to come on. So they're actually just not even engaging with the process of being involved in the game at all. So yeah. I think it's a great point. So I guess, you know, in terms of obviously managing, talking about managing staff and, you know, having strategy for staff, what does that look like?
So for me, and again, you touched on it, I suppose, a little bit earlier as a preconception of what substitutes are. But, you know, a lot of people substitute, I think, with a hope. And I think there's not a lot of rationale behind it. And I think when you do that, it's almost just like chucking a net out into an empty ocean and hoping there's going to be like a fish in there. You know, there's no sort of like rationale as to why you might be doing this, how you might be doing it, when you might be doing it. And what I try and do is the three words I use is try and be more deliberate and effective with our substitutions to create more consistent and effective substitutions. So, you know, one equals another, really. So what I do is we build, you know, player profiles, and we build a little bit more rationale behind the who's, the where, the when's, the why's, and all this sort of thing. And then I give that to the manager, and we work together and other staff. And ultimately, it's their decision, the manager's decision. I will never say, I think you need to do this. Sure. It's all an advisory role, just like every other role in a club is. And then whether they choose to listen to that, then that's completely up to them.
Because I'm just thinking now, you know, if some of the listeners listening to this thinking, all right, you know, love the idea of a substitution coach. We haven't got the resources for one. What are some of the considerations we could start taking into account when we're now thinking about it? So, you know, talking about the what's, the where's, the why's, and the who's. You know, obviously that's, it is contextual, it is subjective around the environment. What are some of the considerations that you think they could start to think about around those sorts of things in terms of why this player might need to come on, or why that player, you know, give us an example, maybe if you can. You don't have to name any names, but
yeah, I think so. A little bit of work I've done recently for a club, we looked at this player's profile and we were trying to understand what his trends were, what his patterns were and stuff. And it leads to the fact that he's probably a better losing substitute than he is a winning substitute. So his mentality when he comes off the bench is a little bit more free, a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more want to go and impact the game. And again, that's something we can work with. Because again, we shouldn't just accept that he can't be a winning substitute, because we need players to be able to do as much as possible. So in the meantime, we can start working with him and saying, well, this is how we want you to adapt your game when we're in this game state. But in the meantime, we've got this player who's doing really well in this game state. So that's only come about us sort of having this curious look into this player's profile and his data and his patterns and trends and that sort of thing. Now, how can we use this to our advantage? So next time we're losing, is this our first substitute? Is this the player that we look to go and influence? Because the last five games he's had as a losing substitute, he's really added value to the game in these aspects and in these metrics. So that's the, again, without revealing too much, but hopefully that answers your question. But
just, to clarify, for anyone that's unaware of what you mean by winning substitute versus that of losing.
Yeah, so a winning substitute is when you're winning, and you want to make a substitute, you know, you're 2-0 up and you think, right, I want this sub to come on, or this finisher, energizer, whatever you want to refer to them as, but I want him to come on and I want him to see the game out. I want to win this game 2-0. So when I come on, I just want him to see the game out. And that looks completely different to when you're losing a game 2-0 and you need a substitute to come on and change the game. Because, you know, one example that we use is pass completion for a winning substitute should be far higher than probably a losing substitute. Because it's all contextual a little bit, but the losing substitute has to come on and try and create something. So he might be playing riskier passes, might be trying things that maybe he wouldn't if we were winning. Whereas when we're winning, we need him to come on, circle it around the back four, drop in, bounce it to the CDM. You know, we need to be a little bit more safe, because at the moment we're controlling the game through possession. That's his role, because we want a clean sheet and we want 2-0. We're losing 2-0. We need him to come on and thread as many passes, through balls, you know, clips over the top. So, while, you know, I'm not saying the losing substitute's pass completion should be then.
There's a bit more context around the numbers, right?
Say that again, sorry.
It's a bit more context around the numbers and the data, right? So you're just understanding that, you know, actually, they probably will have a a slightly lower pass completion rate because they're trying more riskier passes to try and make something happen, right? So I guess, you know, I'm just thinking out loud now, again, putting my mind into maybe some of the listeners in that. Are you suggesting that maybe sometimes you might put players out of position because of those kind of statistics?
I mean, that's a more of a my philosophy thing than I think than I would. I mean, listen, I would say that I would recommend that to a manager, but again, it's his discretion, it's his job, it's his team, and you know, so I would never want to be responsible for that. But by all means, I would suggest it. But for me, yeah, like profiles, and Lee Carsley, the England under-21s boss, said this recently, where he said we don't have a formation, we just have profiles within a team, and I think this links into that, where you can have like a player who's good at possession. Well, where do you need the possession? I need it here. See if he could, you know, see if Trent's a good example, isn't it? Like, he's a right back, but his skills look like he could play most positions. So it's like, where do we need his skill set? Well, let's get him in that position in order to maximise our opportunity.
That's a great way of looking at it. I guess, you know, the question I'll throw at you now then, how does that role at all change for you, if at all in any way? We're working with the goalkeeper that's on the bench.
For me, goalkeeper substitutes or the number two goalkeeper are my favourite people in the world because I think they're the most professional players and people that I've ever met. So all the clubs that go into, and it's a culture that goalkeeping coaches create. That, you know, it's like Ramsdale's a good example of at the moment. You know, how often do you see potentially a player lose his spot and still, you know, congratulate the person who's taken his spot? You know, like, if that makes sense. Like, Ramsdale's come out and said, you know, he wishes Raya really well. You know, he's come out and there was a moment, I can't remember what game it was, but Raya had a good game. Ramsdale's first went out to congratulate him and that sort of thing. And don't get me wrong, again, I don't want a player who's happy to be on the bench because I'd question his mentality, but there's a way about going about that process. And the reason I love these goalkeepers is, so we had a goalkeeper at Wimbledon who didn't play, I think, we only made one goalkeeper substitute all season. So 46 game season, you know, that's 45 times he's been on the bench, but he still straps his hands up like he's starting every single game, you know, with the tape. He goes, sees the physio just in case. He makes sure that he puts the best balls he's ever put into the number one to make sure that they are ready. And I think the way that they go about their warm up is admirable because they're not thinking, I'm not starting today. Because it's not even a thought. They just think, my job here is to warm up this number one. And I think it's a brilliant concept.
Yeah. And I think you're spot on. You know, even through my experiences working with keepers and even watching others, is there always seems to be that camaraderie amongst the goalkeepers. What can we learn from that, do you think? How do we transition that and transfer that element of, I guess, if you like, the goalkeepers union over to the rest of the world of football?
Yeah, it's tough. I don't know how we would. Again, like an example would be when the centre-back was warming up the wide man and then the wide man came on and did what he had to do. That's a great example of a goalkeeper warm-up where it was like, I know that I'm not coming on, but my role can be used here to help him go on and win us the game. And I might get a win bonus for it. I don't know. But so I don't know how. I suppose the little things that I've sort of designed in this process might maybe be changing that towards a more inclusive environment, but goalkeeper specific I'm unsure on, but I love what they stand for. I love the values. I love that, you know, at the end of the game it's always like congratulations, you know, they always sit next to each other as well, and it's like, you know, it's a real like, I want you to do well, because if you do well, I do well. And don't get me wrong, like, I'm going to come for your position Monday to Friday, but like Saturday I'm going to wish you all the best. I'm going to make sure that you go win us the game because it helps me as well.
No, I think it's spot on. I think it's just that I've always thought about it from a goalkeeping perspective, in particular, it's that iron sharpens iron kind of mindset, right? And that, well, look, if I'm going to have to work harder to get in the team, then it's going to make you better and it's going to make me better in return if you're competing with me. So I think it's a great way to kind of look at it as well. And yeah, world of a substitution coach. Where next, Sammy? What, you know, what does the future look like for this? You know, have you had any interest in other people trying to maybe embark on a similar journey going into substitutions? You know, what does that look like?
So, I mean, I don't know too much. I mean, my email's always open for someone, and I think it's a rather niche role because I think you have to have a really good personality and an energy and a charisma and an intelligence to understand people. But you have to have great, you know, great use of data. You have to be really comfortable with data, and you've got to be, I suppose, resilient in a sense that you're having a new role in football, which comes with its adverse effects of, you know, some like the older fashioned people not being an advocate of it, and tough opportunity because, you know, you're trying to bring a role into someone's budget. So, yeah, I don't know whether the role will ever blow up. You know, I don't know what the future of football looks like. I personally think I know it adds value because I've done it enough times with enough clubs to say I've taken them from here to here and I've added this many points and this many goals under him. And then we've made him a better substitute. And so I know it works. I think the future of it could be that you could be a first team coach who specialises in substitutions, just like there might be first team coaches who specialise in set pieces, or a first team who's also a goalkeeper coach, you know, first team coach who's also a coach analyst, you know, again. So I could see it being a hybrid role where you're going Monday to Friday, I want you to come in and do the business and help me, you know, on the pitch and on the grass and in the analysis. But Saturday, I want you to focus on the subs, I want you to focus on making sure they're ready and all this sort of thing. So I think that's the future of the role. I think the future of me looks like, I mean, I want to get to the top and I want to win the Premier League. So that is the goal and that's what I'll be aiming for. And I think for me, I've just got to see opportunities along the way that help me build this reputation and legacy that I care about. I care about legacy. And so, you know, the subs things put me on a brilliant platform. You know, most recently was, you know, did a little bit of work for the national team in the US. So it's about using that platform to get you into other opportunities in clubs in whatever role I believe I can add a value in. But yeah.
Just to build on that really quickly then, you know, I'm just thinking wider now. It shouldn't really, but in what ways, if it has it maybe made you think about individual development plans differently?
Yeah, I think it makes you think about the whole process, because a lot of individual development plans are like, how can we make you the best starter? But for me, this has made me think, like, we've got a squad of 25. There's only 11 going to start. You know, there's another 3, 4, 5 then out that might come on. So you've got to work with those five. But then how do you also work with the 9, 10, 11 that are left out? And so it's about an individual development plan that's holistic. I think that's such an important word in today's world, that in today's footballing world anyways, that you have to design a program that enhances a player's experience throughout their whole process. Because if you only have a process that improves them as a starter, they're not going to get any better as a sub. They're not going to get any better as someone who's not even included in the squad. They're not going to be better in that position or this position. Like, you need a holistic program that's going to improve them, you know, across their whole value. Because whether you're a club that sells, that's only going to benefit you. Or whether you're a club that develops, that's only going to benefit you. So for me, I think there's real value in building a holistic program.
Awesome. Sam, I've got so many questions in my head, but I'm conscious of time as well. But no, it's really insightful. I think, you know, I think first and foremost is just, you know, congratulations to you on your role and how you're getting on. I think it's just a testament to, you know, your character. And I think more specifically, it just really highlights that there isn't just one pathway for us to exist in the game, right? There's so many different roles. And especially now when you look at in coaching in particular, never mind all the other disciplines within it, how many different aspects of coaching we can kind of delve into and kind of work on, and that starting point for that journey can be so different for everyone as well. So I think it's just really kind of really highlights that. And that's one of, again, coming back to the top of the conversation where I mentioned that one of the biggest things I wanted to kind of get out from the podcast in particular was to help people understand that coaching isn't for everyone, but if coaching is what you want to go after, it doesn't have to look the same for everyone. Massively appreciate your time today, and I really, you know, really wish you the best.
No, that's really, really kind. And like I said, just building on that point quickly, like that I've had so many conversations with the throwing coach. He's been a great mentor to me. I've had coaches with ball striking coaches, set piece coaches, goal kick coaches. That, you know, they can be a coach for anything. As long as you can show that, you know, I go into subs as a sub presentation, I say, well, I think I could add another 3 points to your season with my concept on your subs. So if I had another 3 points in the Premier League, that's another one position up, which is another 1.9 million in your pocket, and you've got to pay me pence compared to that. So, you know, as long as you have an angle that shows that you can add value, like goal kicks, throw-ins, and the rest of it, then by all means, there's room for it. You've just got to show that you can add value. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a pathway for everything. And really appreciate the opportunity to come on. Like I said, I'm a big fan of the platform. So to feature on a podcast is really, really good. And I'll definitely be listening to it back and giving it a good rating.
No, Sam, I really appreciate your time again, mate.
Thank you very much. Cheers, guys.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission
right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.